Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brokemarkle, and coming up on the program, one of the last remaining African-American Florida landscape painters, known as the Highwayman Artists, has died.
Roy McClendon was not in a rush to paint. He was trying to make excellent paintings. He wanted them to be fully formulaically resolved, refined.
We'll discuss the struggle for civil rights at the St. Joe Paper Company for much of the 20th century.
The jobs were segregated by race at St. Joe, but then the entire mill was segregated. Workers entered different doors, clocked in on different time clocks, drank from different water fountains, and relieved themselves in different restrooms.
We'll also talk about how the Armed Occupation Act of 1842 impacted the environment. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. In the mid-20th century, a talented group of self-taught African-American painters began producing a large amount of colorful Florida landscapes. Later known as the Highwaymen, these artists sold their paintings from the trunks of cars and by walking into banks, law offices, and other businesses. One of the last remaining original Highwaymen artists, Roy McClendon Sr., died on Sunday, March 2nd. In 1994, art aficionado Jim Fitch named these artists, mostly based out of Fort Pierce, the Highwaymen. In 2001, Gary Monroe wrote the book, The Highwaymen, Florida's African-American Landscape Painters. In 2004, the 26 original Highwaymen artists identified in Monroe's book were inducted into the Florida Artists Hall of Fame. While 26 artists have been identified as being the original Highwaymen, Roy McClendon Sr. was the last survivor of the five founding members of what would become known as the Highwaymen Artists. Gary Monroe.
It was in the late 1950s when Harold Newton had relocated to Gifford, saw the work of B.D. Backus, the white regionalist in Fort Pierce, and made the switch to painting Florida landscapes. At the same time, Alfred Hare was getting ready to graduate from high school. But he had studied with Backus and had learned the principles and the formulaic approach that Backus and other professional artists had used. And Alfred had the notion of becoming a millionaire by his 35th birthday through making paintings. And he knew that he could not have the kind of success that Backus had enjoyed. He was a premier Florida artist. So instead, he painted very quickly to have more paintings to sell for less money, which contrasted from Harold Newton's model, which was more patient and more classical. Those two artists were the progenitors of Highwaymen, but there were those five artists that were the original group. It was besides Alfred and Harold, Roy McClendon, Livingston Roberts, and James Gibson. And then there was another three that I think round out this core group, and those include Al Black. And granted, Al Black was a salesman, but his contribution was that by being such a good salesman, the artists who he represented had to make more paintings and hence paint faster, which resulted in their unique Highwaymen style. Mary Ann Carroll, the sole woman whose distinction is as a colorist, and her colors are just totally unbridled, and were sort of the epitome of the notion of the Highwaymen's sense of light and space, vis-a-vis color and spatial receding through atmospheric conditions. And lastly, Willie Daniels, although he was younger, Daniels seemed to have an equal influence from Hare and Newton, and I think made the encyclopedia kind of images of Highwaymen art. So those eight are the core group. McClendon was central to it and to the Highwaymen aesthetic.
Roy McClendon Sr. was born into a family of migrant workers. They moved from Georgia to Delray Beach to Fort Pierce. McClendon eventually settled in Gifford, the black community of Vero Beach, about 15 miles north of Fort Pierce.
And there he lived next door to Harold Newton, who he emulated. So he learned, he's one of the few skill-based painters in the group, vis-a-vis the Newton model. Harold's work was much more gestural and fluid, less detail-oriented. And most of the other highwaymen artists, the other 26 beyond the core group, were generally folksy in their approach. And also, the other artists, most of them had full-time jobs or came and went within a few years. But this original group and the core group of eight artists had no other professional skills. So they were lifetime artists. And McClendon made gorgeous paintings until the day he died, just a few days ago.
Generally, the highwaymen artists are known for their fast production style developed by Alfred Hare. As Gary Monroe explains, Roy McClendon liked to take more time with his work.
Roy McClendon was not in a rush to paint. He was trying to make excellent paintings. He wanted them to be fully formulaically resolved, refined. And just like his paintings, he was a very genuine, relaxed, easygoing man. And I think it shows in his work. There's no angst in his work, but just these lovely depictions of the Florida landscape. And he made one signature image, one signature painting, usually a fire sky, a very bright orange sky with a large fallen, what seems to be an oak tree branch in the foreground with a pond behind it and an egret in the middle of it. And he must have made hundreds of the same painting. I've always wondered, you know, what scratched the surface of those paintings? Because as I said, there's no angst to these work. They're sublime, but there's no sense of anything that's frightful, which is the origins of the English notion of sublime in art. They're just lovely paintings. And I guess because he's such a gentle person, that's what his paintings are ultimately about.
In the early 1980s, the popularity and productivity of the highwayman artists declined. In the mid-1990s, they enjoyed a resurgence in popularity that continues today. Gary Monroe.
All of the people from New York or California or other places that are moving to Florida, South Florida especially, and bringing a lot of money with them and being cultured people, they're discovering the arts and they're discovering the highwaymen. And I think it's still an amazing surprise to people that are just learning about them, how this phenomenon happened in 1960s, 70s, into the 80s. And they have the means to buy paintings because they're not used to spending $25 on an oil painting, more like $25,000 if you're a real art collector in Manhattan. And I think now their prices have escalated because new blood has entered the scene, and the artists are more popular than ever.
The highwaymen artists produced beautiful paintings, but theirs is also a story of creative people seeking empowerment and economic opportunities for themselves in a difficult period of racial segregation in Florida.
When they were getting started, it was at the tail end of the Jim Crow era. You know, they couldn't cross the bridges to the barrier islands where people lived and worked after sunset. They weren't welcome in certain places, but they had these beautiful paintings and they were like calling cards. And you know, I've interviewed almost all of the artists, all that were alive when I did the research, and not one reported any incidents of racial discord. I mean, they were deferential and they had a beautiful product. And they said they were treated with respect, and they really broke a lot of the racial barrier just through their tenacity and talent. And they had the audacity of hope when President Obama was, you have to say, learning to walk. You know, they were living the dream before Martin Luther King was penning his brilliant speech. I mean, they were trailblazers in that sense too.
Gary Monroe is author of the book, The Highwaymen, Florida's African-American Landscape Painters. Highwayman artist Roy McClendon Sr. died on Sunday, March 2nd at the age of 91. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, including our latest episode, Memories of Palatka. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, dismantling segregation in the South was a slow process. The lag between the Brown v. Board of Ed decision and the desegregation of public schools spanned a decade and a half or more. Lawsuits demanding workplace desegregation were being heard in federal courts in the 1990s. One major lawsuit that fits this category originated in Florida.
Yes, it did. The lawsuit was Winfield v. St. Joe Paper Company and remained in the courts from its original filing in 1976 until 1998. The United Paper Workers International Union, UPIU, claimed that the St. Joe case represented the most protracted, involved, time-consuming, costly, and hard-fought of all UPIP cases. Timothy J. Minchin published an article in the winter 2000 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly that traced discrimination at St. Joe Paper Company from 1938 to 1990. The title of the article illustrates the issue at the company. The title is, "There Were Two Job in St. Joe Paper Company, White Job and Black Job," end quote. Minchin's article on the St. Joe Paper Company employees' struggle for civil rights is part of his ongoing research on American labor history. Currently the author of more than a dozen books on the topic, he is British-born and received his doctoral degree from Cambridge University. His article on the labor struggles at St. Joe Paper Company begins with the completion of the construction on the mill and the implementation of an unyielding segregation of jobs and facilities, follows the efforts of black laborers working through their union to gain advancement, better work conditions, and an end to discrimination, and concludes with a lawsuit that was implemented when all other avenues for change failed.
And Connie, the construction of the St. Joe Paper Company in Florida was viewed as an enormous boost for the Panhandle and the state's economy in 1928. At one point, the company, owned by Ed Ball, one of the most powerful men in Florida, controlled more than 1 million acres of forest and was the largest landowner in the state.
It is important to recognize the wealth and power of the St. Joe Paper Company and that of the paper industry generally. Minchin notes that, quote, "The opening of the St. Joe Paper Company was a reflection of the expansion that the American paper industry made into the South in the 1930s and included several mills operated by International Paper Company and the Union Bag Mill in Savannah, Georgia. In Florida, mills stretched from the St. Regis Paper Company in Pensacola to several mills in the Jacksonville area." Minchin argues that historians have focused on the economy of the mills and neglected the labor issues that occurred in all the facilities. Southern labor historians have focused on other industries, particularly textiles, and ignored the paper industry. Minchin cites only two essays on the topic in his article. Headquarters for the St. Joe Paper Company were in Panama City, but the paper mill was in Port St. Joe on St. Joseph Bay in the Gulf of Mexico. Testimony from black workers across the industry support a history of job segregation and discrimination. A black worker at the International Paper Company in Natchez, Mississippi, remembered, quote, "When I first went there, you didn't do anything but whatever a white person didn't want to do. The whites got the better jobs. Blacks got the lower-paying jobs," end quote. Ellis Dunning, a black worker at St. Joe, told a similar story about his work experience, but in language that underscores the racial hierarchy and the exercise of power by white workers. Quote, "I was named to be the sling man," he recalled, "but I did it all, whatever they wanted you to do. Other words, like children. You tell your child, John, go do this, and Slim, you do that. That's just the way they used us," end quote. Black jobs were more dangerous and dirtier than those performed by whites. Adrian Franklin Gant worked as a broke beater for more than 20 years. Gant described his job as picking up hot paper that fell from the machines whites operated and placing it in a container to be returned to the machine for processing. Quote, "That paper was hot," he said. "We didn't have no gloves. They didn't buy no gloves. You had to pick it up, and throw it in that container. When it falled, it would be hot. You had to run," end quote. White workers operated machines, but black employees had no machines to facilitate their work. It was all manual labor, digging ditches, cleaning out cascades, cleaning out tanks. Regardless of previous experience or specialized skills learned elsewhere, in the St. Joe Mill, African Americans were relegated to permanent manual labor. The jobs were segregated by race at St. Joe, but then the entire mill was segregated. Workers entered different doors, clocked in on different time clocks, drank from different water fountains, and relieved themselves in different restrooms. When civil rights law mandated an end to designated spaces for each race, St. Joe's management removed the signs, but foremen confirmed the continuation of segregation orally. Draughton Bass testified, quote, "We had one old water fountain at the old flume we could use. If we used any other, we was told not to use it," end quote.
Connie, labor unions served as a mechanism for negotiating change in paper mills. Most unions in the South were segregated and controlled by whites. Even so, black workers at St. Joe attempted to address their grievances through the union.
Yes, they did. But as historian Robert Zigerman notes, although union leaders claimed black locals had equal rights and privileges, they were subservient to white locals, which were generally larger and controlled the higher-paying jobs. Blacks found it difficult to challenge discrimination when they could not address the management directly, but were forced to make their complaints through the white negotiators. Things did change by the 1950s, and black union representatives attended negotiations. But even then, discrimination prevailed. First, black representatives were only allowed to attend, not to negotiate or argue. After they presented their grievances, they were required to leave the room, and negotiations were conducted by whites. As black union officer Howard Garland recalls, quote, "When the union and the company reached a decision, the president of the white local would notify the president of the black local, and the black president would call a meeting and tell us what the union done for them," end quote. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits employers from engaging in discrimination based on race, color, national origin, religion, or sex. St. Joe's black workers consulted attorneys in Tallahassee and the NAACP Defense Fund. Thus began a complex process that continued for more than 30 years. In 1968, black and white union locals merged. After that, the union encouraged black workers to file their grievances with the EEOC to build a history of discrimination they faced. St. Joe management refused to address the grievances and denied any discrimination. In 1976, the EEOC failed to negotiate a settlement between the workers and the company, and the workers filed a federal lawsuit. In 1984, the case was heard before a federal judge, and the case was settled in 1988 by consent decree. Legal maneuvering continued into the 1990s as workers contended that the company violated the promotion provisions of the decree. In 1997, the U.S. Court of Appeals rejected the plaintiff's appeal for further relief. Minchin concludes that, quote, "The Winfield case demonstrated that Title VII litigation was no easy panacea when deep-rooted employment discrimination was being tackled. Indeed, Title VII was more effective as a weapon of protest than as a weapon of change. If companies resisted, litigation could become protracted, unsatisfactory, and messy." When asked in 1997 what Port St. Joe was like, in the 1950s and 60s, retired black worker Cleveland Bailey explained, "Just like it is now. They over there and we over here," end quote.
Connie, it's amazing that these problems continue in our society today. This is an important history. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at how the Armed Occupation Act of 1842 impacted the environment.
Dr. Gary DeSantis received his PhD in 20th century American history with a minor in environmental history. He's a cultural historian who teaches at the State College of Florida in Bradenton. I spoke with Dr. DeSantis about his scholarly article recently published in the Florida Historical Quarterly titled An Environmental History of the Armed Occupation Act of 1842. Empire, Cultivation, and Securing the Southernmost Frontier in the Contiguous United States. The Armed Occupation Act of 1842 and its significance in Florida history have received tremendously scholarly attention for years. However, as Dr. DeSantis explained, the act's implications on Florida's environment have been overlooked.
A way to populate and settle and cultivate the territory at the time, and the provisions of the act called for, you know, they'd give you 160 acres, if within 5 years, as a white settler, you could farm at least five of it and set up a domicile or a house or something like that. And, you know, I think it was so successful that within 3-4 years, Florida becomes a state in 1845. But of course, the repercussions on the environment, which you hear very little about, I mean, there's many magnificent overviews and different histories of the Armed Occupation Act. And it seems that the environment and the landscape always take a back seat. So, you know, I just wanted to look at it from a new, refreshing point of view and kind of make the land the primary object involved.
Focusing on the environment's role and impact in this larger story of the Armed Occupation Act of 1842 enabled Dr. DeSantis to explore other themes central to the significance of the Florida landscape for the greater United States in the 19th century.
There was an expression in the 19th century I've heard before that, you know, America needs Florida like a body needs a foot. Okay, so, you know, it was just a matter of time who was going to take control of Florida, whether it was going to be the Seminoles, whether it was going to be the United States sending settlers in.
The United States sending settlers in is a brief way of describing the concept of settler colonialism, which essentially is a system of oppression that aims to permanently displace a population indigenous to the area with a new settler population. In the context of Florida, the Armed Occupation Act effectively authorized white American settlers to impose such a system of oppression as a means to acquire the so-called foot of their body. In addition to the heightened violence between Native Americans and whites, this influx of white settlers drastically altered the environment.
Settler colonialism affects settlement of Florida. As I mentioned before, the settlement of white settlers and cultivation went hand in hand. This way the land, as I mentioned before, can be subdued. They can replenish the earth in terms of American and Christian principles. And with the American white presence of conquering the land and conquering nature, you know, in terms of animals, we see excessive amounts of different species, whether it's birds or fish or mammals, being eradicated during this time. You know, if we look at the trees and the flora growing in the state, you know, many of these were removed for not only housing, but for cordwood, for fires, and, you know, eliminate other predators, whether it's snakes, wolves, bears, panthers, you know, whatever you have. The impoundage and draining of lakes and swamps, another facet that, you know, this is going to be turned into farmland. 5 years after Florida becomes a state, there's already talk about draining the Everglades, okay, because it's going to be this, you know, agricultural paradise that's going to supply all the wants of the United States. Even looking at, you know, offshore mangroves and mangroves growing in riverways, you know, these were wiped out with no second thought of even the ecosystems and the different species, whether fauna or flora, that they support. And of course, diking and impounding waterways and, you know, setting up lighthouses, which are destroying coral reefs and all these different things. I mean, these things started to happen in rapid succession following the Armed Occupation Act. So yeah, these kind of things go hand in hand as I mentioned before, with settlers' colonialism, because it's just another way of pushing native culture aside and setting up the dominance of a white hierarchy.
The rhetoric surrounding Florida as an agricultural paradise with unlimited potential incredibly influenced Florida's environmental degradation in the 19th century.
If I look at a lot of the literature at the time, which I did, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's pamphlets or advertisements or agricultural digests and journals. They're talking about Florida in these terms that it's this new agricultural paradise and this is the place for Americans to go and it'll supply all our wants, these different kind of fruits that we no longer have to rely on exports. We can grow these things ourselves. So, you know, whether it's oranges, pineapples, even things like bananas that were relatively unknown to Americans until the late 19th century, these are all products, you know, whether I look in, you know, newspapers or different agricultural digests and journals, as I was telling you, that are prominent on people's minds.
Florida as a paradise remains prominent in people's minds, particularly seen in the economic boom of the tourism industry throughout the 20th and 21st centuries. Dr. DeSantis considers these contemporary adaptations of economic development and environmental degradation to be wide-ranging legacies of the 1842 Armed Occupation Act.
I don't pinpoint the Armed Occupation Act of 1842, excuse me, as the moment of environmental declension in Florida, but rather it begins the processes that were embraced by American culture during the time. That's why at the end of the article, I kind of point to a writer from about 100 years ago. And he was looking at the 1920s and the land boom in Florida during that time. And he pointed out that Floridians need to start embracing environmentalism and respecting nature to the point of, you know, this overdevelopment in terms of economic growth. Sure, it's great for economic growth, but you're destroying your landscape. You're destroying those things that actually makes Florida unique. It's, you know, developers, they just want to develop something, right? They're going to make their profit. They're going to leave town or they might be across the world. Okay. We're the people that have to stay here and live with this. So I think that's the way we need to like balance this out, right? So people, whether it's legislatures or environmentalists or business people, just so everybody can understand how the protection of the Florida landscape and environment is paramount to our life. So that's why I believe it's the Armed Occupation Act that sets these kind of things in motion.
To learn more about the environmental history of the Armed Occupation Act of 1842, please listen to my entire conversation with Dr. Gary DeSantis on the Florida Historical Quarterly podcast, which is available online at the UCF Stars Library. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, follow us on Facebook at Florida Historical Society and visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.